The word went through the forest that the Malemo was coming, and the clans began to gather at the tribal meeting place below the waterfall at Gondala. Some of the clans came from 200 miles away across the Zaire border, for the Bambuti recognized no territorial boundaries but their own. From every clan area and from every remote corner of the forest they came, until there were over 1,000 of the little people gathered together for the terrible Malemo visitation. Each woman built her leafy hut with the doorway facing the doorway of a particular friend or a close and beloved relative, and they gathered in laughing groups throughout the encampment, for not even the threat of the Malemo could quench their high spirits or dull their cheerful nature. The men met old cronies and hunting companions that they had not seen since the last communal net hunt, and they shared tobacco and tall stories and gossiped with as much relish as the women at the cooking fires. The children squealed and ran unchecked amongst the huts, tumbling over each other like puppies, and they swam in the pool below the waterfall like sleek otter cubs. One of the last to arrive at the meeting place was Piri the Hunter. His three wives staggered under the heavy sacks of tobacco they carried. Piri ordered his wives to build his hut with the doorway facing the doorway of his brother, Sepu. However, when the hut was finished, Pamba closed in the doorway of Sepu's hut and built another opening facing in the opposite direction. In Bambuti custom, this was a terrible snub, and it set the women at the cooking fires chattering like parrots at roosting time. Piri called to old friends. "See how much tobacco I have. It is yours to share. Come, fill your pouches. Piri invites you. Take as much as you wish. See here. Piri has bottles of gin. Come drink with Piri." But not a man of all the Bambuti took advantage of the offer. In the evening, when a group of the most famous hunters and storytellers of the tribe were gathered around a single fire, with Sepu in their midst, Piri came swaggering out of the darkness with a bottle of gin in each hand and elbowed a place for himself at the fire. He drank from the open gin bottle and then passed it to the man on his left. "Drink," he ordered. "Pass it on so that all may share Piri's good fortune." The man placed the untouched bottle on one side and stood up and walked away from the fire. One after the other, the men stood up and followed him into the darkness until only Sepu and Piri were left. "Tomorrow the Malemo comes," Sepu warned his brother softly. And then he also stood up and walked away. Piri the Hunter was left with his gin and his bulging tobacco pouch, sitting alone in the night. Sepu came to the laboratory to call Daniel the following morning, and Daniel followed him into the forest, carrying the camera on his shoulder. They went swiftly, for Daniel had by now learned all the tricks of forest travel, and even his superior height and size were no great handicap. He could keep up with Sepu. They started off alone, but as they went, others joined them, slipping silently out of the forest or appearing like dark sprites ahead of them or behind them, until at last there was a multitude of Bambuti hurrying towards the place of the Malemo. When they arrived, there were already many others before them, squatting silently around the base of a huge silk cotton tree in the depths of the forest. For once there was no laughter nor skylarking. The men were all grave and silent. Daniel squatted with them and filmed their somber faces. All of them were looking up into the silk cotton tree.
"This is the home of the Malemo," Sepu whispered softly. "We have come to fetch him."
Somebody in the ranks called out a name.
"Grivi!"
And a man stood up and moved to the base of the tree. From another direction, another name was called.
"Sepu!"
And Sepu went to stand with the first man chosen. Soon there were 15 men at the base of the tree. Some were old and famous, some were mere striplings. Young or old, callow or proven, all men had equal right to take part in the ceremony of the Malemo. Suddenly Sepu let out a shout, and the chosen band swarmed excitedly up into the tree. They disappeared into the high foliage, and for a time there was only the sound of their singing and shouting. Then down they came again, bearing a length of bamboo. They laid it on the ground at the foot of the tree, and Daniel went forward to examine it. The bamboo was not more than 15 feet long. It was cured and dried out, and must have been cut many years before. There were stylized symbols and crude animal caricatures scratched on it, but otherwise it was simply a length of bamboo.
"Is this the Malemo?" Daniel whispered to Sepu, while the men of the tribe gathered around it reverently. "Yes, Kuoko, this is the Malemo," Sepu affirmed.
"But what is the Malemo?"
Daniel persisted. "The Malimo is the voice of the forest," Seppu tried to explain. "It is the voice of the mother and the father, but before it can speak, it must be taken to drink." The chosen band took up the Malimo and carried it to the stream and submerged it in a cool, dark pool. The banks of the pool were lined with ranks of little men, solemn and attentive, naked and bright-eyed. They waited for an hour and then another, while the Malimo drank the sweet water of the forest stream, and then they brought the Malimo to the bank. It was shining and dripping with water. Seppu went to the bamboo tube and placed his lips over the open end. His chest inflated as he drew breath, and the Malimo spoke from the tube. It was the startlingly clear, sweet voice of a young girl singing in the forest, and all the men of the Bambuti shuddered and swayed like the top leaves of a tall tree hit by a sudden wind. Then the Malimo changed its voice and cried like a duiker caught in the hunter's net. It chattered like the grey parrot in flight and whistled like the honey chameleon. It was all the voices and sounds of the forest. Another man replaced Seppu at the tube, and then another. There were voices of men and ghosts and other creatures that all men had heard but none had ever seen. Then suddenly the Malimo screamed like an elephant. It was a terrible, angry sound, and the men of the Bambuti swarmed forward, clustering around the Malimo in a struggling, heaving horde. The simple bamboo tube disappeared in their midst, but still it squealed and roared, cooed and whistled and cackled with 100 different voices. Now a strange and magical thing took place. As Daniel watched, the struggling knot of men changed. They were no longer individuals, for they were pressed too closely together. In the same way that a shoal of fish or a flock of birds is one beast, so the men of the Bambuti blended into an entity. They became one creature. They became the Malimo. They became the godhead of the forest. The Malimo was angry. It roared and squealed with the voice of the buffalo and the giant forest hog. It raged through the forest on 100 legs that were no longer human. It revolved on its axis like a jellyfish in the current. It pulsed and changed shape and dashed one way and then another, flattening the undergrowth in its fury. It crossed the river, kicking up a white foam of spray, and then slowly but with awakening purpose began to move towards the gathering place of the tribe below the waterfall at Gondala. The women heard the Malimo coming from a long way off. They left the cooking fires and seized the children and ran to their huts, dragging the little ones with them. Wailing with terror, they closed the doors of the huts and crouched in the darkness with the children clutched to their breasts. The Malimo rampaged through the forest, its terrible voice rising and falling, crashing through the undergrowth, charging one way and then the other, until at last it broke into the encampment. It trampled the cooking fires, and the children screamed as some of the flimsy huts were knocked askew by its ungoverned anger. The great beast raged back and forth through the camp, seeming to quest for the source of its outrage. And suddenly it revolved and moved purposefully towards the far corner of the camp, where Piri had built his hut. Piri's wives heard it coming, and they burst from the hut and fled into the jungle. But Piri did not run. He had not gone to the silk cotton tree with the other men to fetch the Malimo down from its home. Now he crouched in his hut, with his hands over his head, and waited. He knew there was no escape in flight. He had to wait for the retribution of the forest god. The Malimo circled Piri's hut, like one of the giant forest millipedes, its feet stamping and kicking up the earth, screaming like a bull elephant in the agony of a ruptured bladder. Then abruptly it charged at the hut in which Piri was hiding. It flattened the hut and trampled all Piri's possessions. It stamped his tobacco to dust. It shattered his gin bottles and the pungent liquor soaked into the earth. It kicked the gold wristwatch into the fire and scattered all his treasures. Piri made no attempt to fly its wrath or to protect himself. The Malimo trampled him. Squealing with rage, it kicked and pummeled him. It crushed his nose and broke his teeth. It cracked his ribs and bruised his limbs. Then suddenly it left him and rushed back into the forest from whence it had come. Its voice had changed. The rage was gone out of it. It wailed and lamented as though it mourned the death and the poisoning of the forest and the sins of the tribe that had brought disaster upon them all. Slowly it retreated, and its voice became fainter, until at last it faded into the distance. Piri picked himself up slowly. He made no effort to gather up his scattered treasures. He took only his bow and his quiver of arrows. He left his elephant spear and his machete. He limped away into the forest. He went alone. His wives did not go with him, for they were widows now. They would find new husbands in the tribe. Piri was dead. The Malemo had killed him. No man would ever see him again. Even when they met his ghost wandering amongst the tall trees, no man or woman would acknowledge it. For Piri was dead to his tribe forever. "Will you help us, Daniel?" Victor Umeru asked. "Yes," Daniel agreed, "I will help you. I will take the tapes to London. I will arrange to have them shown on public television in London and Paris and New York." "What else will you do to help us?" Victor asked. "What else do you want of me?" Daniel countered. "What else is there I can do? You are a soldier, and a good one, from what I have heard. Will you join us in our fight to regain our freedom?" "I was a soldier long ago," Daniel corrected him, "in a cruel, unjust war. I learned to hate war in a way that no one can until they have experienced it." "Daniel, I am asking you to take part in a just war. This time I am asking you to make a stand against tyranny." "I am no longer a soldier. I am a journalist, Victor. It is not my war." "You are a soldier still," Victor contradicted him. "And it is your war. It is the war of any decent man." Daniel did not reply immediately. He glanced sideways at Kelly, on the point of asking for her support. Then he saw her expression. There was no comfort for him there. He looked back at Victor, and the old man leaned closer to him. "We Uhali are a peaceful people. For that reason, we alone do not have the skill necessary to overthrow the tyrant. We need weapons. We need people to teach us how to use them. Help me, please, Daniel. I will find all of the young brave men you need, if only you will promise to train and command them." "I don't want..." Daniel began, but Victor forestalled him. "Don't refuse me outright. Don't say anything more tonight. Sleep on it. Give me your answer in the morning. Think about it, Daniel. Dream of the men and women you saw in the camps. Dream of the people you saw killed or deported at Fish Eagle Bay and the mass grave in the forest. Give me your answer in the morning." Victor Umeru stood up. He paused beside Daniel's chair and placed his hand on his shoulder. "Good night, Daniel," he said, and went down the steps and crossed in the moonlight to his own small bungalow beyond the gardens. "What are you going to do?" Kelly asked softly. "I don't know. I really don't know." Daniel stood up. "I'll tell you tomorrow, but right now I'll do what Victor suggests. I'm going to bed." "Yes." Kelly stood up beside him. "Good night," he said. She was standing very close to him, her face tilted up towards him. He kissed her. The kiss held for a long time. She drew back only a few inches from his mouth and said, "Come," and led him down the veranda to her bedroom. It was still dark when he woke the next morning under the mosquito net with her. Her arm was thrown over his chest. Her breath was warm on his neck. He felt her come softly awake. "I'm going to do what Victor wants," he said. She stopped breathing for a few moments, then she said, "It wasn't meant as a bribe." "I know," he said. "What happened between us last night is a thing apart," she said. "I wanted it to happen from the first day I met you. No, from before that. From the first time I saw your images on the screen, I was half in love with you." "I've also been waiting for you for a long time, Kelly. I knew you were out there somewhere. At last I've found you." "I hate to lose you so soon," she said and kissed him. "Please come back to me." Daniel left Gondala 2 days later. Seppu and 4 Bambuti porters accompanied him. He paused at the edge of the forest and looked back. Kelly was on the veranda of the bungalow. She waved. She looked very young and girlish, and he felt his heart squeezed. He did not want to go. Not yet. Not so soon after he'd found her. He waved and forced himself to turn from her. As they climbed the lower slopes of the mountain, the forest gave way to bamboo, which was so dense that in places they were forced to their hands and knees to crawl through the tunnels which the giant hog had burrowed. The bamboo was solid overhead. They climbed higher and came out at last onto the bleak heath slopes of the high mountains, 12,000 feet above sea level, where the giant groundsel stood like battalions of armoured warriors, their heads spiked with red flowers. The Bambuti huddled in their blankets that Kelly had provided, but they were miserable and sickening, totally out of their element. Before they reached the highest pass, Daniel sent them back. Seppu wanted to argue. Koko, you will lose your way on the mountains without Seppu to guide you, and Karakai will be angry. You have never seen her truly angry. It is not a sight for any but the brave. Look up there, Daniel pointed ahead to where the peaks showed through the cloud. There is cold up there that no Bambuti has ever experienced. That shining white is ice and snow, so cold that it would burn you like fire. So Daniel went on alone, carrying the precious tapes inside his jacket close to his skin, and he crossed below the moraine of the Ruwata Magufu Glacier and came down into Zaire 2 days after leaving Seppu. He had frostbite on three of his fingers and one of his toes. The Zairean district commissioner at Mutsora was accustomed to refugees coming across the mountains, but seldom with white faces and British passports and $50 bills to dispense. He did not turn this one back. 2 days later, Daniel was on the steamer going down the Zaire River, and 10 days after that, he landed at Heathrow. The tapes were still in his pocket. From his Chelsea flat, Daniel telephoned Michael Hargreave at the embassy in Kahale. "Good Lord, Danny, we were told that you and Bonnie Mahoon disappeared in the forest near Sengi Sengi. The army has had patrols out searching for you." "How secure is this line, Mike?" "I wouldn't stake my reputation on it." "Then I'll give you the full story when next we meet. In the meantime, will you send me that packet I gave you for safekeeping? Get it to me in the next diplomatic bag." "Hold on, Danny. I gave the package to Bonnie Mahoon. She told me that she was collecting it on your behalf." Daniel was silent for a beat as he worked it out. "The little idiot. She played right into their hands. Well, that settles it. She's dead, Mike. As sure as fate. She handed over the package and they killed her. They thought I was dead, so they killed her, nice and neat." "Who are they?" Michael demanded. "Not now, Mike. I can't tell you now." "Sorry about the package, Danny. She was very convincing. But I shouldn't have fallen for it. Must be getting senile. No great harm done. I have some much stronger medicine to replace it. When will I see you?" "Soon, I hope. I'll let you know." Despite the short notice, the studio gave him a cutting room to work in. He worked without a break. It helped to allay his sadness and guilt at what had happened to Bonnie Mahoon. He felt responsible. The final cut of the videotape did not have to be perfect, and it was not necessary to dub the Swahili dialogue into English. He had a copy ready to show within 48 hours. It was impossible to get through to Tug Harrison. All Daniel's calls were intercepted on the boss switchboard and were not returned. Of course, the number of the Holland Park address was not listed, and he could not remember the number that he had telephoned from Nairobi to check on Bonnie Mahoon, so he staked out the house, leaning against a car with a newspaper as though he were waiting for someone, and watching the front of the building. He was fortunate. Tug's Rolls-Royce pulled up at the front door that same day, a little after noon, and Daniel intercepted him as he climbed the front steps. "Armstrong! Danny!" Tug's surprise was genuine. "I heard that you had disappeared in Yuboma." "Not true, Tug. Didn't you get my messages? I telephoned your office half a dozen times." "Oh, they don't pass them on to me. Too many freaks and funny bunnies in this world." "I must show you some of the material I have been able to shoot in Yuboma," Daniel told him. Tug hesitated and consulted his wristwatch dubiously. "Don't mess me around, Tug. This stuff could sink you. And boss." Tug's eyes narrowed. "Sounds like a threat." "Just a friendly piece of advice." "All right, come in," Tug invited, and opened the front door. "Let's have a look at what you have for me." Tug Harrison sat behind his desk and watched the tape run through from beginning to end without moving, without uttering a word. When the tape was finished and the screen filled with an electronic snowstorm, he pressed the remote control button, ran the tape back, and then played it a second time, still without comment. Then he switched off the tape and spoke without looking at Daniel. "It's genuine," he said. "You couldn't have faked it." "You know it's genuine," Daniel told him. "You knew about the mining and logging. It's your bloody syndicate. You gave the orders." "I meant the labour camps and the use of arsenic. I knew nothing about that." "Who's going to believe that, Tug?" Tug shrugged and said, "So, Omeru is still alive." "Yes, he is alive and ready to give evidence against you." Tug changed the subject again. "Of course, there are other copies of this tape," he said. "Silly question," Daniel agreed. So this is a direct threat? Another silly question, Daniel said again. You're going to go public with this? That's three in a row, Daniel said grimly. Of course I'm going public. Only one thing will stop me. That is if you and I can make a deal. And what deal are you offering? Tug asked softly. I will give you time to get out. I will give you time to sell out your interest in Ubomo to Lucky Dragon or anyone else who will buy.